everybody, and welcome back to Thank Godzilla. It's Friday. It's Godzilla, and that means it's Friday. Is that right? My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I love me some Shin Godzilla.
Woo! Spoiler alert, Whitney likes this one. This is our podcast here at the Critically Acclaimed Network, where we've been reviewing every single Godzilla movie in every single goddamned order. We've been doing every Godzilla movie and every Godzilla-adjacent movie, and we're finally here in, like, this modern era. And I mistakenly thought this would be a pretty clean sweep. It's going to be like, okay, so we got the 2014 Legendary Monsterverse, then a Shin Godzilla, and then it's a bunch of Monsterverse movies, and then just a little capper on the top, Godzilla Minus One and Godzilla X Kong. And I forgot there's so many other movies that came out in this decade. We actually have
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we're in what has come to be called the Reiwa era.
Yeah.
It's worth reminding listeners that the eras of Godzilla are named after whoever is emperor of Japan at the time.
Except for the Millennium
technically,
Era.
Except for the Millennium Era. Yeah. And also, Godzilla 1985, Return of Godzilla, came out while Showa was still emperor. Heisei wasn't emperor yet. So, but it's technically been, like, kind of grandfathered in. So
all
that's
the sequels
part of the
were part
era.
Of the Heisei era. Yeah, it's a little unclean, but it's fine, and that's how we... and all of them represent a different era, a different aesthetic, a different sort of creative take in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and also, like, a different continuity in the case of most of these.
And a different generation as well. People who, like, grew up on Godzilla now get to make Godzilla their own, and they are influenced by very different versions of these characters, and we're going to see a bunch of different Godzilla movies that have some similarities, but they're definitely distinct artistic visions, and I think it's really exciting.
And we mentioned a lot about how the Millennium Era was really, like, each of the films in that era were separate. Like, they were each existed in their own separate continuity, except for, like, a couple that overlapped or were direct sequels to the others. I still like to kind of, like, squint my eyes a little bit and pretend that they're all of a piece except for the one in the middle. Yeah. GMK is clearly its own thing. It's like dealing with an entirely new mythology. It's treating the monsters really differently.
Ghidorah is the good guy. It's weird. But
The events don't really overlap, and they keep talking about how, oh, this is the first time we've seen Godzilla since 1954. But I still like, they're all of a piece. Godzilla looks really similar. The tone is really kind of similar throughout those.
Yeah.
So they're all of us canonically connected as far as I'm concerned.
They're variations on a theme at least. Yeah.
Yeah, the Reiwa era is going to be all over the place because we have Shin Godzilla, we have some anime films that are like a trilogy that are of a piece, but then we also have Godzilla Minus One, which is clearly its own animal as well.
Yeah.
And we'll have to see where they go from here. I assume that the makers of Shin Godzilla would continue to make Godzilla films, but instead they pivoted and started doing Shin versions of other popular tokusatsu entertainments.
Yeah,
so there's also a Shin Ultraman and a Shin Kamen Rider.
Yeah. So the Shin Godzilla and the Shin Ultraman and Shin Ultraman, they're from filmmakers Hideaki Anno and Shinji Higuchi, and they're best known really for Neon Genesis Evangelion. Actually, I don't know. Are you familiar with Neon Genesis Evangelion at all?
Familiar, but I haven't seen it.
Okay, so I'm not going to... That's a whole other podcast. That's a lot. But Neon Genesis Evangelion was a real breakout anime here in America at a time when they weren't as easy to find in the 2000s. And... it also has a bunch of giant monsters. It is about these giant beings called angels who keep trying to attack the Earth, and we don't know why. And a bunch of kids are enlisted who basically sort of sync up with these giant robots and fight the monsters and save the world. And that sounds like it might be kind of fun, right? Neon Genesis Evangelion is a series about, like, serious debilitating depression. Like, that's... That's the text. That's not even the subtext. Like, it is an extremely emotionally charged, harrowing downer of a show. I made the mistake, and I'm going to phrase that very carefully because I think it's a brilliant show. But I made the mistake of binging Neon Genesis Evangelion one weekend when I was house sitting for my parents and I had no other entertainment available to me. I had just these DVDs that I had gotten. And alone in a house in the middle of the night with the series finale of Neon Genesis Evangelion, like before the movies, those are bleak, was one of the most depressed like moments I've ever had in my life because the art was effective. So
yeah.
One of the things that they're exceptionally good at, and I haven't seen all of their films, but you can see from Neon Genesis and Evangelion that they're good at taking these sort of genre forms and injecting them with a seriousness that feels very real. And in the case of Neon Genesis Evangelion, it was an emotional reality. And in the case of Shin Godzilla, it is a much more sort of naturalistic reality. Godzilla is still a very weird monster who does very weird things, but the world around him is almost almost absurd how realistic it is when it comes to just depicting if Godzilla attacked today in 2014, or no, it's 2016.
2016.
Yeah, 14 was the Gareth Edwards movie. No, if Godzilla attacked now, there'd be so much red tape, you guys. Like half the movie would have to be red tape. and rather than make up like some fun stuff to ignore that, they're like, no, we're gonna do the movie about the red tape. And that is such a bold choice. And boy, that shouldn't have worked. That should not have worked. But by God, it really does.
It really does. It's to the point where they're like the human character. It's almost like that Kurosawa thing where I've talked before about how Akira Kurosawa is very adept at turning crowds or groups of people into sort of like a singular character unit. We think of like the villagers in Seven Samurai. There are some distinct villagers, but more than anything, the villagers are just sort of a character unto themselves.
Yeah.
Same with the gangsters in Yojimbo. It's like there's a few gangsters you can pick out, but the gangs are the single characters. And I feel like Godzilla is the monster and there's a plucky reporter and there's like sort of a bitter scientist and there's a few politicians you might be able to pick out. But the sense I get from Shin Godzilla is that these characters are all part of the Japanese bureaucracy, whether it's the government or the scientists or the reporters. They're all sort of operating as a single unit. So even though some characters do have little miniature stories of their own, it's more than anything, it's just all of them sort of functioning at once.
It's really not about no one really has an arc to speak of, really. It's not about that. It is about, it's almost like, I think you're overstating the significance of the reporters, but it's almost like a Michael Mann movie. And one of the things that's great about a lot of Michael Mann movies is the way that he's like, here's a bunch of people. They might have an interesting job, but all that matters is that they're good at it. And I'm going to show them doing their job, and it's going to be fascinating just because they're good at it. Now, the irony is that in Shin Godzilla, they're actually really bad at it, a lot of them. And what happens is what is dramatized over the course of the film, and the film is inspired by some more recent events at the time, the Fukushima disaster and the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. And so these were, you know, really devastating events, and we saw in real time, much like, you know, America saw, you know, how how badly Hurricane Katrina was handled by our infrastructure, you know. So so there seems to be quite a bit of commentary on that. Now, without knowing in great detail what was going on in the Japanese government at the time watching this film, it's an interesting balance between a certain amount of national pride. We're going to suck it up. We're going to do our job and we're going to get things done. But that can only be done by busting through a kind of a political age gap where a lot of the young people are just idealistic and just want to do the right thing and do their job. and a lot of the older guard are more concerned about preserving their career, preserving their legacy, not looking like fools, than they are in actually making split important snap decisions, doing the right thing at the right time. And that waffling, that lack of a that lack of confidence, or just that they're just portrayed as not very good politicians, and some of them die, and it feels like there's a certain value system being judged there, and it brushes up, I worry sometimes, against an almost a Randian quality in terms of, you know, here all these bureaucrats, the great people will end up getting things done. But I do believe that ultimately it does seem to be about, and this is something that I think we see in American politics as well. The people who run this country that you and I are in, America, United States thereof, for the most part are, and this is not in and of itself a problem, but for the most part, they're very old. Mm-hmm. There isn't like a whole generation of young politicians who represent millennials or even Generation X all that much. Still the people who have been in charge since like the 80s and 90s are still running things, and they're running things the way they've kind of always run things. There've definitely been some changes, but their values are very have not shifted as dramatically as a lot of us would like, but there isn't a younger generation of politicians being ushered in to sort of push us forward and actually maybe make some real systemic institutional change. And I know that there's a lot of frustration about that. I'm frustrated by that.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I think that's something that we're seeing is that, you know, a lot of the threats that we face in the world today, whether it's climate change, a very real existential threat, or sort of, you know, the extreme income inequality, a lot of these large issues are going to have a bigger impact on young people because that's the world they're going to have to live in for many decades. And it just feels like we don't have enough of a say in fixing it. So I sense a certain amount of that indignation in Shin Godzilla. But again, that's my view as a Westerner. That's my view as an American. And that might not necessarily reflect the people who making the film. I cannot speak for them. I can only speak to how this movie spoke to me.
Yeah. I can see that. I can appreciate this sort of age gap. And that's actually not something I really keyed into when I was watching Shin Godzilla this time around, that it's about these sort of career politicians butting heads with the younger characters. What I saw was a bunch of characters, old and young, who seemed to take pride in the bureaucracy. And, you know, this is, and maybe I'm just getting like whiffs of, to mention Kurosawa again, whiffs of Ikiru, which is also a film very much about bureaucracy. And that one's actually about like fighting the bureaucracy, kind of pushing through it and using it as a useful tool to do kind of a noble deed. Here I see these people and it's almost comedic the way this film plays it out, where a bunch of people in matching suits rush into a room. There's lovingly, almost fetishistic shots of the folding tables they have to set up, that they put the machinery on, and how they're going to put all the printers over there. Like, how they're actually setting up the actual office where they're going to take care of Godzilla is just as important as the discussion they're about to have, where they're going to discuss what color the form is going to be that they have to fill out so they can petition the military, so they can actually, like, it's all about making these decisions in this really kind of, there's so much attention to detail that clearly this film is saying that that's supposed to be the way things work. And it's satirizing it, but I think it's also celebrating it, kind of, that this is the way Japan operates. This is the way the government and all of these bureaucracies are supposed to operate.
Yeah.
And these are supposed to be the things that protect us. And of course, the tragedy / joke of the movie is that when something truly extraordinary happens, when an actual disaster hits,
yeah,
they're completely ill-prepared. All they can do is discuss and talk about the bureaucratic details and not actually take action. And even when they do, it's kind of hastily made and they're always passing the buck. There was a shot or a scene where Godzilla is like, finally, like, we'll get to the sort of the life cycle of Godzilla.
Well,
in this
we'll
movie,
do the whole plot where Godzilla,
Godzilla like is finally standing upright at one point and they're going to attack it. And I think there's like a full maybe minute and a half where they're asking permission up the chain of command if they can fire.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, oh, I saw Godzilla. I have permission to fire. I open fire. It's guy in a helicopter asks his immediate superior if he has permission to fire. The immediate superior calls the government office. Someone asks the next person down the table, and then that person asks the prime minister, and then the prime minister's like, eh, and someone's like, we need an answer. Okay, fine. Then it goes right back down the chain again. And that level of bureaucracy and micromanagement, you know, on one hand, you know, there's accountability.
Yeah.
So there's something to be said for that. On the other hand, it's really difficult to do things in a timely manner when that's the process. And I think there's a certain irony to that. There's a line in this movie, I was trying to find it while you were talking, because I think it spoke to what you were saying. And I saw the subtitled version of this, which, by the way, right now this movie actually isn't very readily available. I saw it on Crunchyroll, and I saw it through the Amazon subscription to Crunchyroll. Okay. And so I can't say if this is on Crunchyroll itself or just the Amazon version. The subtitles were out of sync by a lot.
Oh, no.
And a movie this dialogue heavy with a lot of different characters in the room talking to each other.
A lot of captions, too.
Yeah. When the subtitle arrives on the screen, pop, and then the person speaking that line doesn't say it for 5 seconds.
Ooh, gosh.
That's a lot. That might not sound like a lot, but it adds up, and it got really, really. Fortunately, I'd seen the film before, and I didn't need, you know, it was clear for me who was talking, but it was a level of concentration that absolutely should not have been necessary. And there is a real problem in the subtitle industry right now. There's a real lack of quality control all around.
That's frustrating, because for years that was the complaint about a lot of anime, was that the dubbing or the subtitling was really bad, or the translation wasn't very good, but then they kind of stepped up their game.
They did. And it's gotten a lot better. And there's always, you know, potentially something, a mistranslation or a misspelled word or something like that. That happens. But yeah, it's definitely a much different, you know, much different world out there for subtitles. So there's no excuse for that. It's just really, really bad. But in any case, this is from the subtitle version. Don't knock red tape. It's the foundation for democracy.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's something to be said for that. So,
But yeah, that's. Yeah. I feel like the filmmakers are trying to point out that red tape is a really important part of the modern Japanese national character, that it's all about sort of a very structured government, a very disciplined, structured government where everybody communicates in a very specific fashion.
Yeah. And
so it's the modern Japanese machine versus the monster. That's the fight in this movie. And it's weird how much I love that idea, because it actually goes to something a little bit more thematic. Also, I love the aesthetics of this movie, but we'll get into that in a second.
Yeah, we'll just jump right into it, because what we're talking about is really emphasized in the opening scene. So at the beginning of the movie, it actually opens like that movie Zombie, aka Zombie 2, where there's a ship in the harbor.
Movie. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's a ship in a harbor, and it's a ghost ship. Someone was in it. We don't know who. They've just vanished. Ooh, what a mystery. And then all of a sudden, there's a mysterious disaster. A plume kind of shoots up out of the water, and dark red liquid starts pouring into the underground tunnels where people drive. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly an immediate emergency, a disaster. Things need to be done. Things need to be handled very, very quickly. And we cut from a certain organized, like, sort of chaos where we get a lot of different points of view on the ground, as people just sort of react to it, kind of like the footage you would see kind of randomly on the news or on social media as something disastrous happens. And then we cut to in the halls of government, people moving into a room, you know, sitting down, prime minister talking to all of their various aides and experts. And then they move into another room for another meeting, and they're talking about, and they're trying to figure out, like, okay, so what is this? Is it volcanic? Is it some sort of heat pocket? Like, what happened here? What is the cause? And they're all making all of these theories, and we meet essentially our protagonist, Rondo Yaguchi, who's a deputy chief cabinet secretary. He's very low on the totem pole, and he's the one who's saying, hey, I'm looking at all this footage, and it looks like there's some kind of giant animal in the water, and maybe that has something to do with it. And everyone's telling him to shut the hell up, because that's obviously absurd. They go into this really big boardroom where he brings that up, and everyone shuts him down. It's like, this is politics. Be serious. You're destroying your career. And then someone says, oh, hey, we should turn on the TV. And it's like, bo, there is a giant monster out there. And I appreciate I've talked about this before. There's a line in one of the Hannibal books, and they use it in the TV series. There's an emotion that everyone recognizes, but we've never really named, that is the happy anticipation of being proven right. No one believed you, but you know they're right, and there will come a moment. You know you're right. There will come a moment when they'll have to admit it, and it's going to be so fucking vindicating. And here, it's within seconds, which is weirdly satisfying. And so, all of a sudden, they went from this, like, sort of like the Oval Office is frame of reference, to a big room with tons of politicians in it, because we're going to have a really serious meeting about it. And then when it's a giant animal disaster. We've never had anything like this before. The first thing they say is, okay, let's move to a different boardroom. And they do.
Yeah.
And that's right out of Veep. Like, that's just, it's comical that that's the priority right now, but there's a process here and they're going to be following it. They, and the initial, like, Godzilla is mostly like a tentacle at first. It's really abstract.
Yeah.
They invite some biologists, some experts, to look at the footage and to give their opinion. And it's a whole room full of old guys. And all of them say, oh, I don't have any information about that. I'm not going to stake my reputation and my career on any kind of guesswork. So they're useless. And then our young politician friend, he invites someone who's basically new at that department, at that division, to come in and just say, yeah, I don't have a career to protect. I'm based on everything I'm seeing, it's this, 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 and this. And that right there is kind of the political sort of commentary in a nutshell, which is, if you're not prioritizing your career, you can probably get a lot more done in politics. You know, it's not about getting reelected. It should be about actually doing the right thing, whether or not you're reelected. And I think that's something.
On Star Trek, there's always, at least on Star Trek: The Next Generation, there's an element of caution to every story.
Yeah.
Like, we need to experiment something. They don't just sort of, like, recklessly do something. In fact, when somebody's reckless, they're scolded on Star Trek: The Next Generation. You can't do that. You can't dump that much power into blankety blank. Mm-hmm. You have to go through
the protocol. Proper channels for everything. Yeah.
So, yeah, this idea that, adherence to protocol is actually very important, and testing things out and not saying something rash and actually trying something for real, trying something for real takes like a concerted, organized effort on everyone's part. And I feel like that's what's going on here. And in Star Trek, I admire that, you know, they have these like bizarre science fiction problems, but there's still like an element of protocol to it. There's a professionalism that I really like about Star Trek. Mm-hmm. The professionalism on display in Shin Godzilla is great on a governmental level. I wish more politicians did that. We need to experiment. We need to run it by people. We need to make sure everything's safe. So when we, you know, measure 10 times, cut once, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think there's just this fun, absurd juxtaposition between all of that protocol and a tentacle that is destroying the city.
There's this interesting thing that I think there's a weird dichotomy almost that I think this happens dramatically, but I think in real life people expect this of their politicians as well. You want protocol. You want to be concerned about. You want your politicians to be concerned about accountability before major decisions are made. But in a crisis, you need decisions to be made quickly because time and lives are of the essence. But that doesn't mean that that should be made without accountability. It just means there's a chance accountability might have to come afterwards if you made a mistake, because you have to act very, very quickly, oftentimes without all the information that you possibly can have. And that can lead to incredibly reckless, terrible, almost unforgivable choices at times. But that's the job sometimes. I do not envy someone in a position of that much power. That is an unbelievable amount of stress. The majority of presidents, if you look at their picture, like the day they entered office and the picture the day they left office, they all look like they've aged 20 years.
Oh, well, yeah, they go gray. They all go gray.
They almost all, if they hadn't already, they almost all do, unless they're dyeing their hair orange.
But even when you look at the bad presidents, you'll notice, and this is something like a theater teacher pointed out to me, when a politician is really stressed out, they carry all their tension in their upper lip. Mm. So you'll see that they're kind of, their lips are kind of pursed, and the space right underneath their nose is like really taut and tensed up. Like even orange presidents get that. So
they're concerned that there's this giant monster just off the coast of Japan, and they are trying to figure out, like, how much of a threat is it, and could it wind up on land? And the biologist, even the one who's giving them answers, is like, based on its current structure, probably not. And they decide, and they have a press conference.
They even say, that's a biological impossibility. It couldn't, like, stand, or it couldn't.
Well, they don't initially say that. They say it probably couldn't, and then they have a press conference and they say ahead of time, don't say anything, we don't know for an absolute fact. And the guy gets up on the stage and he says, there is a monster in the bay, but don't worry, it is literally impossible for this thing to end up on land. And then before he finishes making his statement, a guy comes up and says, like, in the middle of the press conference, it's on land. Right in there immediately. And that's when we get our first good look at this version of Godzilla. And the thing with this version of Godzilla is that pretty much every version of Godzilla we've seen before has been a mutation. Whether it's a mutation of some kind of just random lizard or some previously unknown form of dinosaur, it was mutated to become the kind of creature that it is. With the exception, actually, of the legendary monsterverse, that's just an ancient god, basically. This version is a mutation as well, but unlike the other Godzillas, we're seeing it in the process of mutation. It doesn't show up as the Godzilla that we know. It shows up in almost a larval stage, where...
But in fact, it's this weird thing where we don't even know it's Godzilla yet.
Yeah.
And it looks so strange and so unlike Godzilla that you might be tempted for thinking that this is like a different creature that Godzilla is going to fight at some point.
Yeah, it's not a biped. It's got legs, but they look almost vestigial. It's got these big, giant, lidless eyes, which
fish eyes.
When you look at it in a still image, it looks fake. It looks like you put like googly eyes on an image in post. But when you're watching it, and the visual effects in this movie range from excellent to pretty good. But
what's pretty good? Because I think they're pretty good across the board.
I think the designs are excellent across the board. I think there are definitely some moments where the compositing looks more realistic than others. I think there's definitely a few shots of the creature that make it look less real than other times. But generally speaking, it's excellent. And I'm just saying, this initial design, you look at a picture of it, you might think it's kind of comical. But you see it in motion. It's like an organic tidal wave. It's just rolling down, like, the street.
It's like
pushing
it's
things
like
out
a fish.
Of its way.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a fish flopping around, yeah.
Flopping around. It's, yeah, those big, scary, lidless eyes. It's gushing out all of that red fluid.
Oh, it's so gross, yeah.
It's one of the only times in the entire Godzilla series where I've been scared of Godzilla.
Yeah, ditto.
Where Godzilla, yeah, like, really seemed like this mindless force of destruction. We've talked a lot in previous Godzilla podcasts about how, about Godzilla's character. You know, who is Godzilla? What kind of person would Godzilla be if Godzilla were a person?
Yeah.
And, you know, Godzilla's even spoken and had speech bubbles and had friendships and alliances and enemies. Yeah. You know, Godzilla has character.
Yeah.
In this one, Godzilla doesn't have character, and that's what terrifies me.
Yeah.
Godzilla is more than ever before a thing.
Yeah. It's a force of nature. It doesn't seem to have any sort of meaningful agency. It's just, its existence threatens us in every conceivable way. And it is tearing through this city. They don't know what to do about it. And they don't start evacuating the city until way too late. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of unnecessary death and destruction. And the decision to do something about this, to actually engage the Japanese military, is a really fraught one. And they talk about this, that this would be the country's first military action since World War II. And there are, like, still sanctions in place about that. There's, like, they talk about, like, how, like, do we involve the United States? Can we ask the United States, who are, like, off the coast, for their help? And apparently, and I'm going to take the movie's word for this, the rules are you're not allowed to just ask the U.S. to fight. You actually have to start fighting and then ask the U.S. for help. And they're not necessarily
prepared
for that.
Yeah, I think that's the way alliances function. You can't just say, hey, we're being attacked, come in and attack our bullies. Like, you have to, like, I too don't know the exact rules, but I think, there's actually, like, Geneva conventions or something about that.
That's how they're presented in the film. And, you know, films, they usually do research, but sometimes they gloss over things for the sake of drama, so I can't say how accurate it is. And it's interesting to see the movie's sort of conflicted sense of pride in that. You know, like, there's a bit where they talk about beware of unfounded optimism when it comes to military action, because that was the attitude they had going into World War II, and that didn't work out great. So they're trying to be very, very careful about it. And just when things are going to kick in, Godzilla stops. He mutates, and then he just sort of stops. just right there. Just immobile, just hanging out. And that's when they're, like, waiting for that long period to get approval to shoot him.
Right.
After they finally do, Godzilla kind of, like, perks up a bit, and then Godzilla returns to the water. And he'll be back. Don't worry. But it gives everyone, like, some time to sort of regroup. And they decide that what they need, and I appreciate this line, and again, I'm going off of the subtitle here, is, quote, a crack team of lone wolves, nerds, troublemakers, academic heretics, freaks, and general pains in the butt of the bureaucracy. They just get everyone who would normally be, you know, that one person in the movie who says, no, it's, you're not listening to me. I have the right theory. Just get all of those people in the same room and let them figure it out. I kind of appreciate that. Yeah.
And well, here's the fun thing. You think that phrase evokes something. Like, you're going to get, like, cool guys who chew on toothpicks and have wraparound shades, or, you know, like, some woman's going to ride into the lobby on her motorcycle. Like, we're going to have, like, actual rock and roll weirdos who have, like, really wild ideas. No, they're just more people in suits.
Yeah.
They're slightly nerdier and yell a little bit more, but they're just more suit-wearing people.
They're just the ones who think outside the box and usually get shouted down in the meeting because they're the only ones saying whatever they're saying. Yeah. And already, after like less than a day of this Godzilla crap, they realized, oh, those people are usually right already. So let's just get them all in a room. And and they start asking some meaningful questions. And they start asking, like, this thing is gigantic. Where is it getting its energy from? It can't possibly be eating enough to justify its size and the amount of energy it exerts. And they theorize that it's got kind of an internal nuclear reactor. And that blood that Godzilla keeps spurting out of its gills is actually its coolant. That's how it's staying cool. And when it stopped, when it just went dormant for a bit, that was its nuclear reactor overheated. And it needed to let it cool down, and that's why it returned to the ocean. So, on one hand, we've got a walking nuclear reactor that's spilling radioactive blood all over Japan. On the other side, on the other hand, there's a downside to that for Godzilla, and that may be able to be something they can exploit. We meet a few other characters. One we actually meet, Kyoko Patterson, who is a Japanese-American politician, the daughter of a senator, who becomes the point person for relations between Japan and the United States in this.
And there's a lot of American characters.
There are. She's the one who gets the most screen time. She's the one who gets the most to do. She's the person it all gets filtered through. And she's great. She's cocky. She's wonderful. And I love her to pieces. Mm-hmm. And the relationship between Japan and the United States in this movie is interesting and complex. I feel, because on one hand, the extreme militarization of the United States, look, they're just going to come in here and shoot the damn thing.
Yeah.
Is on one hand, it's cartoonish. And on the other hand, speaking as an American. Yeah. Like that's also, about right.
Maybe there was something that happened between the US and Japan at some point that would give the Japanese government that view of the United States. There might be something
in history. Right.
Some event that might have happened.
Right. Right. But the thing is that it's still a practical solution. Like we've got a Godzilla and we've got this country and all they're really good for is blowing shit up.
Mm.
Well, do we actually let them do that? And that's an issue that arises throughout the entire film. How much are we going to let the Americans do? Because if we do let the Americans do what they do, it's probably going to be really, really terrible. And to the movie's credit, they try to push that. We don't meet this character, but we do get to know them. There is a professor named, I think it's Goromaki, who predicted Godzilla. He did a lot of research into the way that nuclear dumping would create an event like this. And it was his boat at the beginning of the movie where it was abandoned. And no one knows what happened to him. And that is a weird subplot that doesn't go anywhere. Like, what happened to this guy? Is he going to... Well, he never comes back. You expect him to, like, sort of... Some people have even theorized... I was looking it up online. There are some people who even theorized that, like... he mutated into the monster. Like, that's why, like, his boat was suddenly empty and then Godzilla showed up, that maybe there's some connection there. I don't think there's any... I think that's all kind of...
That's like fan theory.
It's not an uninteresting fan theory, and I'm not saying that... I'm not saying it's like...
There's nothing in the text to support that, though.
There's definitely, like, circumstantial evidence that doesn't deny that, but I don't think there's anything that literally supports it. But it is weird that the character never actually comes into play. All we really have are their notes, and they have these very mysterious notes and this one giant giant poster sized sort of diagram. They can't even decipher it. They have no idea what it means. So he'll be important later as well. We also find out there's actually finally some decision as to what to call this damn thing. And I like the way that the movie reverses it, because usually it's named in Japan Gojira, and then Americans screw it up and call it Godzilla. Here, calling it a god was intentional from the beginning. And the Japanese version of Gojira comes after the Godzilla, which on one hand, it's kind of heretical. On the other hand, it kind of fits this movie. I do like just treating it as a god. That's what Godzilla is, really.
Godzilla is
what else
nature.
Would he be? Well, he's nature, yeah, but I'm... nature is when we think about, especially our ancient gods, they're gods of nature. Poseidon is the god of the sea. You know, Zeus throws lightning bolts at you. These are entities that are considered very keyed into the natural world. These gigantic, almost inexplicable forces that define and set the parameters for our lives. You know, oh, we can only go so far over there because there's a big fuck off ocean. Yeah, thanks, Poseidon. I have to invent boats now. You know, so I always like appreciating it. There's the American movies have like do this in a ridiculous way. I think it's Bradley Whitford. And when someone says, like, in King of the Monsters, like, someone says, oh, my God. And then Bradley Whitford's like, Zilla. Thank you, Brad. I might be misremembering that, but, like, that something like that is in there. It's like, oh. I love the way Rebecca Hall says Godzilla in those movies, because she emphasizes the god. She says Godzilla. You know, like, oh, the great god, comma, Zilla. Mm. I know. There's something about it. It's just kind of the deification of the character kind of works for me. Anyway, they come up with a theory, and right now it's just a theory, that they could stop Godzilla by, if the blood is its coolant, and it needs that in order to basically not overheat and melt down, it needs it to survive, could they use a blood coagulant to clot Godzilla's blood, so it cannot serve that function, and then Godzilla would overheat, power down. Or freeze. And that is indeed where we're going to go with this. But first, we have to consider nuclear bombs. Godzilla comes back. Oh, by the way, Godzilla comes back, and there's a little bit, where we see, like, protesters in the street actually worshipping Godzilla, which kind of is an interesting touch. You don't really
which
see
happens,
that?
It's really brief, but it's not a big part of the movie.
It's a good detail, though, I think.
It's a good detail. I think a lot of the people are, you know, admire Godzilla's power or whatever. It doesn't really add much to the movie.
No,
because the movie's not about that.
It's just a little flavor in one scene. But yeah, Godzilla is back, and now Godzilla is kind of the Godzilla that we already know. He's got the same basic shape. He's got these weird, gnarled, upturned, almost like Wicked Witch hands. You know, they're not the T-Rex hands, kind of pointing forward, used for balance. I don't know what exactly they're supposed to represent, but they creep me the hell out. This version of Godzilla is like cracked and made of coal, and you can see like the red kind of pouring out of him. And
Godzilla has like a bit of an expressive face, but still has like those round dead eyes when they do close-ups of the eyes.
Yeah.
And
the expression he has, by the way, is evil. He looks really mean in this version.
But and I said this before, I feel like we're not looking at a guy.
Yeah.
You look at something like Godzilla Minus One, Godzilla's very expressive, has a lot of, like, has big shoulders and hands and body movements, like, very human qualities. This is the least human Godzilla. Yeah, these, like, little tiny floppy arms that it can't do anything with. Mm. Godzilla's head is even smaller than in previous ones. And later on, when Godzilla, like, opens its mouth...
Oh, my God.
It opens its mouth so... like terrifyingly wide, like the entire top of its head hinges back almost.
Yeah, and the bottom jaw spreads open. Yeah, his lower jaw spreads open like a python.
Yeah,
and it's just unnatural, and that's something that I think we've gotten really used to, the idea of Godzilla as an entity that we sometimes forget that's actually really fucking weird. And if we saw that in real life, it'd be really, really scary. They bring this unnaturalness back to Godzilla. And I swear to God, I have never been so creeped out by Godzilla as I am by this Godzilla.
Yeah, yeah.
When he opens his mouth, it is demonic. mm-hmm. in a way that very few movies even are able to capture these days. I feel like we're so used to all of the fantastical imagery that being able to add an element to Godzilla that makes him feel legitimately unnatural and threatening is a lot, honestly.
Takes a lot of creativity, a lot of willingness to be that terrifying. Yeah, it's there's a temptation, I think, on maybe the filmmaker's part to make Godzilla as like relatable, because that's what we're here to see. Forgetting that Godzilla is supposed to be really weird and terrifying.
Yeah. Well, we get used to anything after a while, you know?
Yeah, and in fact, Godzilla is so uncannily strange in this movie and just so terrifyingly off-putting. And the fact that we see his entire head sort of fold open to sort of do the nuclear breath, I had the impression that Godzilla doesn't have a brain. That Godzilla is like this mass of living tissues and animal impulses.
Yeah.
But this is not a Godzilla that is making decisions or has any kind of perspective on what's going on. Godzilla is, to say it again, a thing. Godzilla is this terrifying monster.
When I was a kid, I read a short story collection. I think it was called Dinosaur Fantastic. And it was a bunch of short stories from a bunch of different authors. And the only thing they all had in common was they were all about dinosaurs in some way.
Okay.
And some of them were really fun. Some of them were really scary. The one I always liked best was, and I'm going somewhere with this, and it's pretty thin, I admit all the way, but this is what I remember remembering. The story opens with Emperor Nero, and everyone's really upset with him because of the whole Rome burning and him fiddling thing. And he's like, I didn't even fiddle. Where did that come from? I mean, yeah, burned. That's on me. But I don't know where the fiddling is. Just that's just bad press. And then all of a sudden, like, someone comes into Nero and say, oh, hey, Nero, a god is here to see you. What? Yeah, the gods are here. They want to see you. And Nero's like, okay, show them in. And in walks, and it's described as a guy in a business suit. And the guy guy says, hey, for the sake of conversation, to you, we're gods. We're from the future, Olympus. Yeah, that's it. And we have decided it would be really cool to bring dinosaurs to ancient Rome. And Nero's like, what? Dinosaurs. This is really big monster. You're going to love them. And so we're just going to do that. We think it'd be really cool. And so they just create a time portal and they shove a bunch of dinosaurs into ancient Rome. And now, like, ancient Rome has to, like, find a way to live with all of these dinosaurs. Like, an entire new field of, like, business opens up that's just cleaning up the poop because there's so much of it in all the streets. But as time went on, and they developed, like, coexistence with these giant, you know, terror lizards. This was before everyone thought they were birds. It then cuts to, like the present in this alternate reality. And dinosaurs are just, like, just people that we live with, but they're dinosaurs. Like, T-Rexes, for example. Everyone's like, oh, T-Rexes. Like, they're not that scary, really. Those hands everyone thinks are so useless? They're not useless. They're actually perfect for playing poker. And so T-Rexes are actually the greatest poker players in the world, and that's what they're great at. And, and you know how stegosauruses have, like, an extra brain in their tail? Turns out that's just for, like, phone numbers they don't use very often and, like, holiday recipes. You know, they only trot out once a year. So
this is a very strange story.
I love that story so much, and I need to find that book again somewhere. I haven't had that book since I was a kid, but I always loved that story, and I always thought about, like, you know, just so Godzilla would probably be good at poker, and he probably has one of those walnut brains, and yeah, it's good for stuff, but he's probably just got some recipes in there, and the rest of it he's just going on instinct. But I digress. So Godzilla, and the other thing Godzilla does is, you know, sometimes in the older Godzilla movies, he has, like, sort of like this energy pulse radial attack. Here, he gets so full of energy that it shoots out the cracks in his body at all angles, almost like a broken disco ball.
It's like the fins on Godzilla's back are blast out all the energy instead of him breathing. Although he does breathe out, yeah, like, the radioactive breath as well.
Yeah, but they also, like, shoot up all around in all different directions, and they blow up a whole bunch of helicopters, including the one the Prime Minister is in. So now, after that huge display of power, Godzilla goes dormant, and it's just standing there motionless in the middle of Japan.
Yeah, by going dormant, it's not like he swims away. No, just no. Godzilla's standing.
Just standing there, just chilling the fuck out. And I forget, I think they estimate they have like 18 days or something before he's going to charge up enough again to actually become a threat. So they have that much time to try to solve this goddamn problem. Meanwhile, Godzilla's just sort of standing there. That would scare the shit out of me. Getting out of there. That's, whew, no thank you. But on top of it all, now they have a crisis in government where... who's going to be the Prime Minister now? Who is in charge? And they decide, in a very Battlestar Galactica kind of way, that it's not like the next person you'd think in line. They ended up giving the gig to the Minister of Agriculture just because he's been in government longest. But he's just this like really quiet old man. And then they're like, He's at a desk and they're briefing him on all these horrible things. And when the meeting is finally over, he sits down and he's mad because that meeting took so long that his lunch, which is like a bowl of noodles, has gotten soggy. And he's just like, what else could go wrong today? And it's like, okay, so he's maybe not the person who should be in charge right now. He doesn't seem to be entirely present.
I remember that scene, but yeah, that goes into what you were saying about how this is about sort of intergenerational bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And how, you know, the younger generation is going to have much more to say and do than the older generation.
Yeah. They talk about how Godzilla can keep evolving. Like, this isn't even Godzilla's final state. They theorize it could grow wings. It could even get smaller again. It could shrink.
And what... Imagine if they were daring enough to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
like we're gonna so radically change Godzilla that he doesn't even look like Godzilla anymore.
And I want to foreshadowing here. We'll talk about it when we get to it. I forgot the last shot of this movie, and it freaked me the fuck out. And I can't wait to talk about it. We'll wait a little bit longer to talk about it. So, in addition to our heroes trying to find a way to create. All this blood coagulant. Oh, and they finally solve that big poster mystery. It turns out it needs to be folded like origami, and only then can you actually decipher it. But it basically proves their blood coagulant idea is a good one. They have a very limited amount of time to create tons of this blood coagulant. And meanwhile, China
they've said that this blood coagulant like isn't going to kill Godzilla.
Yeah.
Like, they know it's only going to, like, slow it down a little bit.
Right. So that's a danger. But meanwhile, it's an international incident as well. China and Russia are concerned that when Godzilla is done here, it's going to go to China and Russia, because those are the next closest countries, which admittedly is a concern. So they want to take over the whole Godzilla operation because Japan's infrastructure has been collapsing and maybe they won't be able to do it themselves. And the U.S. is concerned that Godzilla could go in the other direction and end up on the West Coast. And so it just seems more and more likely that the United States is going to want to nuke it.
Yeah.
And again, well,
that's kind of why we have America in this movie at all.
Yeah.
It's just America is just there to provide the literal nuclear option.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically. And it's something that the Prime Minister, who, again, really wasn't ready for this position and doesn't want to do it. He's like, well, this is what I'm going to go down in history for? What a horrible thing. He can't think of another way out of it. So he begrudgingly goes along, but everyone around him, including him, is like, after World War II, we're going to let this shit happen again?
Yeah.
Like, that's unforgivable. We can't do this. There must be some other way. And it actually requires them to team up with France. They enlist France at the United Nations to stall the United Nations and give them the time that they need in order to solve the problem with science. Awesome science. There's one line I do like in this movie where they talk about how America just wants to drop nuclear bombs on anything. And one of the politicians of the film say, the Americans would do that if it was in New York. Which on one hand is kind of a cheeky thing because they do that in all the New York movies anyway. Because that was what the 2014 movie was about. It was in San Francisco, but we're going to drop a bomb on it. You know, we're going to nuke San Francisco to save America. But on the other hand, yeah, we do a bunch of not very well thought out shit, don't we? Even to our own detriment. So I do feel like we're being read to filth a little bit by Shin Godzilla, but I also feel like I don't have a lot of good rebuttals, you know? So I'm just going to let it have it.
Sorry, say again. We're being what?
We're being read to filth. They've got our number. We're being roasted. And it's all fair game as far as I'm concerned. I don't have a lot of pushback on that. Like, yeah, fair enough. Can't really argue with that. there's the good line where someone says, "Why let other countries blow our country up when we could save it?" Yeah. So they stall for time. It's all working out. And they get all the blood coagulant, and their plan is pretty fucking wild, actually. They put a whole bunch of bombs in the trains in, like, I think it's in Tokyo, and they run them right into Godzilla so that Godzilla is stunned, and while Godzilla is stunned, they shove a whole bunch of tanker trucks with, like, giant nozzles and just shove the nozzles into Godzilla's mouth and try to pour as much blood coagulant as possible as they can before Godzilla gets up again, and then they retreat, and then they have to do it again, and it's like, it's kind of ridiculous, actually, but I don't know, man. It feels like it's hard to come up with new ways to kill Godzilla. You know? If the nuclear option is off the table, like, how do we do it? And I did appreciate in the subtitles that there's this one guy in the movie when this plan is in operation, and what he says is, okay, we've injected him with 20% of the dosage. Okay, 30% of the dosage. And then when that guy is off camera, the subtitle would credit, like, the character, so you know who's talking. And it just called him Dosage Guy. And I have a new character I want to play in a movie next to Ain't No Rule Says a Dog Can't Play Basketball. I want to be Dosage Guy.
Dosage Guy.
All I do is read off the percentage of something.
That's another detail we didn't really mention was we've been talking about earlier on about how the bureaucracy and setting up all of those tables. Every time we enter a room, there's a caption.
Yeah.
Every time a character speaks, there's a caption explaining who they are. And there's a comedic scene where they enter into a room and the screen literally fills with text of, like, what's going on and all of the characters and where that is. It's like, okay, yeah, this is going back a little bit. But yeah, this is about the bureaucracy.
They end up filling Godzilla with enough coagulant to actually, like, just kind of freeze Godzilla in place. And that's just where Godzilla is now. I'm surprised they didn't shoot, like, a couple of missiles into him just to shatter him like the T-1000. But they didn't. Godzilla's just a big old statue in the middle of Japan. There's a bit of good news, which is that even though Godzilla was highly radioactive, this feels like we're just going to cut everyone a little bit slack because the movie's almost over. The half-life on that radiation is unusually short, and the area will be livable again in just a couple of years. Which, like...
Oh, well, thank goodness. Yeah, which is only a few years.
I mean, hey, better than the alternative. It could have been a lot worse, but also... Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And Japan will rebuild again, and they're gonna do a lot better. And Yaguchi, our main guy, who was in charge of that crack squad and was kind of... the one guy, even though he was the lowest level politician getting things done, is kind of being told, like, you're going to be prime minister someday. Like, everyone knows it. Like, you're too young to do it now. You're not going to get in. But, like, seriously, it's inevitable. And Kyoko, who is the Japanese-American attaché, she even just says, like, yeah, I'm going to be president, and I need you to be prime minister when I'm president. So stay in politics. Get that shit done. And... The movie ends with a big old shot of Godzilla And then we kind of...
Oh, God, it's the scariest thing in the world.
We follow Godzilla, and again, Godzilla froze in place. So, like, whatever Godzilla was in the middle of is just frozen and stopped. And remember we said Godzilla would keep mutating? We follow Godzilla, and we follow up his tail. And Godzilla has a really vertical tail in this version, which is an interesting choice.
Yeah.
And at the tip of its tail, we see that it was mutating into people.
Yeah.
It was mutating like into humans, its predator.
Human skeletons, like, started to grow, like, this really kind of skeleton. Almost looks like the creature from Alien, mm-hmm. like, so kind of growing out of his tail.
Like, these really creepy, inky, black skeleton creatures, but with, like, Godzilla spikes on the back. And it's just a whole bunch of, like, if we had been a few seconds later, those things would have, like, popped off of its tail and started, like, invading. And it's so Lovecraftian. It's so... eerie. Like, I'm literally shocked that I don't remember that shot. Like, that was the one thing in the movie where I'm like, did I look down at my notes or something at the end or the first time I saw this movie and I just don't remember that? Because that is a terrifying final shot. It's a right out of a fucking Clive Barker story. I love it. And it suggests suggests that there could have been more in this series, and they had talked about doing a sequel. It didn't pan out. But yeah, really messed up shit.
Well, I think the idea, and the idea is, yeah, Godzilla, I think, is still evolving and is going to turn into people. And what does that mean? Well, that's us. We are the bureaucracy fighting the monster, but the monster is also humanity. And it adds this kind of almost George A. Romero sort of underpinning to the final shot of the movie.
And that's fitting, actually, because a lot of Romero's better films actually incorporate sort of... it's not just that monsters would attack, but how would humanity as a whole respond? And that's kind of Shin Godzilla's vibe as well.
I kind of like browsed a little bit, like what's sort of the consensus on that ending? You know, was that supposed to be a sequel? And all of the explanations were very literal ones. Like, oh no, that was the scientist and it was his DNA that somehow got.
Yeah.
It's like, no, that's not interest. That's like the least interesting way to look at that.
Yeah. But it is to be fair. It is a little ambiguous. They never explicitly explain it. So if your interpretation is not terribly complicated, that's allowed. They left it ambiguous, and they gave you the opportunity. So, you know, whatever your interpretation is, it's probably fine, unless it comes from, like, out of nowhere and has nothing to do with anything. But, like, there's multiple ways to interpret that ending, and regardless, there were human monster hybrids popping out of Godzilla's tail, and that's freaky in all of those interpretations. And it really, really freaks me the fuck out.
Importantly, it's freaky.
Yeah, it's really freaky. And that's the thing that Shin Godzilla, I think more than any other Godzilla, is, even though you can look at, you know, the human drama, and I love the human drama on this one. It's not melodramatic. It's actually, it's simultaneously comical and terse, which is an odd... sort of a tone to strike and continue striking throughout the movie, and I think it really works. But it's also the scariest Godzilla movie.
By far.
Yeah, there's...
like, even more so than the first one.
Oh, yeah. The first one has that somber intensity. It's great. I still think it's one of the very, very... It might be the best Godzilla movie. When we're done here, we're going to talk about what we think the best ones were. Like, in the last episode or so, we should at least...
Well, I mean, we've talked about it as we go, which one
we should put a capper on it. We should put a capper on it. And, like, sort of, like, after we've seen them all or re-seen them all, looking back, what were our favorites? What one do we think is the best? But, yeah, I think this is the scariest Godzilla has ever been. There are moments in things like Godzilla Minus One, which are really, really scary, but this is consistently a terrifying Godzilla. And there's something really awesome to be said for that. And when you look at the other Shin movies that they made. They made Shin Ultraman and Shin Kamen Rider. Movies that are successful to varying degrees. I don't think any of them are bad, but I think they're all trying to do very different things. They're trying to take these concepts that are, easy to take for granted because they're so ingrained in sort of the pop culture consciousness. Like, we no longer think about how weird they are. And
right,
what they do, to varying degrees, but all successfully, I think, is remind us of how fucking weird that would be if it happened now. Like, it would be genuinely, it would feel fresh, it would feel new, it would feel terrifying. I love Sheen Ultraman. I think Sheen Ultraman is a pretty goddamn great movie, and I love the way that it takes the episodic nature of the show and creates an episodic movie, and that gives it this epic feel, like it's really covering so much ground. And the idea that there are these, like, there's this giant alien robot and he's fighting these giant monsters, and oh hey, once in a while one of the main characters gets turned 100 feet tall and wanders around the city wondering about their place in the universe. It's a really existential crisis blockbuster, because like, if all of that shit was true, if we kept running into aliens and all of them wanted to destroy humanity, what would we think? How would that change the way we view ourselves? How would our philosophies be challenged? And I think Sheen Ultraman does that really, really well. And I think Sheen Kamen Rider is way more of just an action movie than all of that, but it's got some really cool, fun, exciting stuff in it, and I like it a lot too, but I think it's the least of the three.
I'm less familiar with, like, I know Ultraman kind of okay. I really know Godzilla really well, but I know very little about Kamen Rider, so maybe that was just the filmmakers exploring the extant themes of the series and the Kamen, you know, the franchise.
Yeah. To the best of my knowledge, those are not all in the same canon. Like, it's not like Sheen Ultraman and Sheen Kamen Rider take place in the same universe as Sheen Godzilla, so we're not going to be covering them in detail, but they are worth checking out. If you like Sheen Godzilla, or even if you didn't, you should check out at least Sheen Ultraman, but I think Sheen Kamen Rider is a lot of fun too. And that is that. This movie was the most financially successful Japanese produced Godzilla movie to date. It has since been surpassed by Godzilla Minus One. It was critically acclaimed, especially in Japan. I think there were some American critics who absolutely were on board with it. I was right at the start. I was one of its early boosters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't think it's necessarily what everyone was expecting or wanted from a Godzilla movie, so it got some of a mixed reception here, but it was a big fucking deal in Japan, and it kind of swept the Japanese Academy Awards. It won Best Editing, Best Sound Recording, Best Lighting Direction, Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography, and Best Director and Best Picture.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it lost a few. It lost Supporting Actress. It was nominated twice in that category, and it lost Best Music and Best Actor. But still, that is a monster, man. That's, like, huge.
See, this was the Academy Film Prize, it's called in Japan. Yeah. And I was just looking it up here, so I have it here in front of me. Mm. Your Name, which is a really famous anime here in the United States, won one screenplay. Mm.
And Your Name was a huge financial success in Japan. Like, it was, like, yeah. It was respected here, but it was a blockbuster.
Sadly, none of these other movies, I think, got wide distribution in the United States. Yeah, so I'm not always recognized. Like, Her Love Boils Bathwater is the name of one of the winners, and that's a great title.
Yeah,
I think I've heard of Rage. Mm.
And incidentally, this is the first but not the last Godzilla to win Best Picture, because Godzilla Minus One did as well, and that's totally fucking awesome.
Oh, this is funny. For the international feature at the Japanese Academy Awards, nominated that year were Star Wars The Force Awakens, Zootopia, The Martian, The Revenant, and the winner was Sully, the Clint Eastwood movie.
What?
Sully beat The Martian, Zootopia, Star Wars, and The Revenant to be the outstanding foreign language film.
That's a weird crop of films. I like how they're, like, kind of all from America. That's kind of interesting.
Those are all American productions, weird, aren't they? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm wondering that if that's how international audiences feel when they see the American Academy Awards, because here in the United States, it's really weird the way they choose nominees. Like, a country has to choose one picture.
Yeah.
So it is just this kind of random cropping of films.
The the nominees for Best Foreign Language Film at the most recent Japanese Academy Awards were, I guess it got a different release over there, Tar, Barbie,
okay.
Killers of the Flower Moon, a French-Belgian film called Driving Madeline, which I haven't even heard of, and the winner... It'd be Tar, it'd be Barbie, it'd be Killers of the Flower Moon, it'd be Driving Madeline. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1.
It's so weird. That's all right.
It's an interesting choice. Bless them, it's an interesting choice. Anyway, but that's Shin Godzilla, and that is it for this episode of Thank Godzilla. It's Friday. We will be back next time. With a review of Kong, Skull Island. We're going back to the MonsterVerse for the film that reintroduces King Kong. We've had a few other versions of King Kong in the interim from the last time we saw King Kong. We had the 1970s King Kong. We had King Kong Lives. We had the Peter Jackson version. Mm-hmm. But none of those ever canonically met Godzilla, so we skipped them. Now we're going to get to Kong, Skull Island, which is... what if King Kong, but a Vietnam movie?
Yeah. They took a lot of aesthetic cues. We've mentioned this already from Apocalypse Now. There's all the shots of the helicopters, and there's this certain kind of washed out kind of classic looking photographies. They tried to make it look a little bit more like the 1970s. Who's like the brave hero actor? It's not Dan Stevens.
No, it's Tom Hiddleston.
But it's a Brit. It's Tom Hiddleston. Right.
Tom Hiddleston, Brie Larson, Samuel L. Jackson, John C. Reilly. It's a good cast. We'll be talking about that. I have only seen Kong Skull Island on an airplane. I never saw it on the big screen, which, it should be seen there, but I don't have that option available to me now. But I get to see it on my big screen at home, and I'll get to finally, give it and I liked it. By the way, at the time, at the least. But it's a different experience when you're thousands of feet up in the air and you're terrified of flying. So it should be... I'm looking forward to seeing it with fresh eyes. And we'll see how I feel it holds up. That is coming up. And if you're listening to this on the main feed, our episode about Kong Skull Island will already be up right now at our Patreon page. Patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where all of our patrons, regardless of what tier you're at, $1 and up, you get all of our new episodes ad-free, and you get Thank Godzilla It's Friday 1 week early. So thank you to all of our patrons. I hope you're enjoying all of that stuff, and we have a bunch of bonus stuff available as well. We just did a commentary track for Highlander 2, The Quickening, because it's the only sci-fi movie that we know of that takes place in 2024, the far-off year of 2024.
The people demanded it. Yeah.
We have our Star Trek podcast reviewing every Star Trek ever made. We've got, I think, 200 episodes of that in the can already. We've got Only the Best, speaking of international cinema, where our next episode of Only the Best will be an episode of Only the Best International, where we're going to talk about some of the best picture, some of the films that were nominated for Best International Feature at the Academy Awards in the 1950s. And a lot of them are films that are not terribly well known, and I'm excited to watch them. I think I've only seen one of the nominees next coming up.
I'm really looking forward to this crop because, they're all films I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, we're going to get to that as soon as we can. That takes a lot of research, but we love doing it. We hope you're enjoying all that stuff, and thank you to everyone who supports us on Patreon. We can't do this without your help, and that means a lot to us that you want to help. If you want to join the Patreon, God knows we'd appreciate it. If you can't afford to, but you want to help the show, please subscribe if you haven't already, and please leave us a review wherever you find us. Take 20 seconds out of your day to give us a star rating and a couple of words. And it really, really helps us a lot. I cannot overstate that.
Pushes it up the algorithm, lets other people find it.
So that would help us out a lot. Thank you. And, of course, you can follow us on social media. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
We are at Critic Acclaim on Blue Sky and on Twitter. We're overdue for letters episode, but you can always email us, tell us your thoughts on things, ask us questions. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter to the critically acclaimed network, PO Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. All right, so once again, thank you, and we'll see you next Friday. For Godzilla Friday. Roar.